If you want to know what people think about important issues in New Zealand, just ask a taxi driver. And if you want to know what people think about the big issues in a changing China, ask taxi passengers. Frank Langford is a former Shanghai-based national public radio correspondent, now based in London. And in Shanghai, he offered free taxi rides in exchange for free and open conversation. That's a big ask in China, where an authoritarian political system discourages free speech. The cast of characters he met offers an insight from the back seat. His new book is The Shanghai Free Taxi: Journeys with the Hustlers and Rebels of the New China. And Frank Langford joins me now. Hello there.
Happy to be here.
Such a great idea, I suppose, because taxis and hair salons just make great confessionals, don't they?
They do. I mean, I started as a taxi driver actually 3 decades ago when I was growing up in Philadelphia and got out of college. And I drove taxis for a while, and I found that I met all kinds of different people who took me to all kinds of different places in the city I never would have known. And so I decided three decades later to try this formula in Shanghai and see if it would work to kind of yield sort of more grassroots stories and kind of get a sense of what ordinary people were thinking about how the country was changing.
And one theme that comes up over and over again in the book is the dizzying pace of change in the new China. Can you describe that rapid change and its impact on Chinese people?
It is. I mean, I think what I found fascinating is some of the passengers and people I got to know is how their lives have been transformed. There was a couple of lawyers that I got to know who grew up in a small farm in a remote village in Hubei province. And by the time I met them, they were lawyers and they were working in the tallest building at the time in China. And this is the sort of thing in the United States or probably New Zealand, it might take 2 or 3 generations to make this kind of leap. This was, they had started off and I even went back to the village to see where they had grown up. Their parents had been subsistence farmers. And here they were, one of them working for an international law firm, traveling to Paris and to Italy with his child. So it was just remarkable, the economic change and also how it really did improve lives dramatically.
And you've been covering China off and on for 20 years. There was a bit of an assumption, I think, that prosperity would make things more open, but that hasn't happened. Why do you think? Why did you need to moonlight as a taxi driver to have these honest conversations?
Well, I think it hasn't happened for a variety of reasons. I think the government has been, first of all, the prosperity has built in a lot of residual goodwill towards the government. And I think most Chinese are very pragmatic. And even though they may not like the censorship and they would probably like a lot more certainty and rule of law, I think they feel as long as the government can deliver on the economy, that they will put up with it. I also think, coming from the United States, you know, democracy and the things that the United States preaches don't look quite as good as they did 20, 25 years ago. When I got to China in the late 90s, Bill Clinton was president of the United States. The United States was at peace. It was running budget surpluses. Now we have terrible turmoil in the U.S. with President Trump. The global financial crisis undermined confidence in the U.S. system, as did the Iraq War. So some of the people that I got to know, they had great, they idealized the states initially, but over time began to see the benefits of the authoritarian system. So it was great to, in many cases, I got to know these people over 4 and 5 years. And so it was interesting to see how their thinking changed over time.
You called your service the Free Loving Heart Taxi, which I'm guessing
yes.
is slightly lost in translation. Who got
it? Yes, well, that was the way that was translated. That was my news assistant, who was very helpful. And it's called in Chinese, Mianfei Aixingche, which best translated is Free Loving Heart Taxi. And it does sound much better in Mandarin than it does in English, certainly. But the thing that's interesting about it is it worked for Chinese people. They understood the idea behind the cab, and that's all that mattered.
Yeah. So who got in your cab?
Lots of different people. Everybody from, there was a pajama salesman, factory workers from the provinces. I ended up driving a psychologist back and forth to visit her clients. I drove a man who was a barber who would also help out older people who were shut-ins, and he would go and cut their hair in charity work. So a wide variety of people up and down the socioeconomic ladder. So I got a lot of different points of view on what was happening in China.
Did your passengers feel that they were putting themselves in jeopardy by taking a ride with you and talking to you?
No, because here's what was great, and I confess I'm not this clever. I had no idea if this would even work or how it would play out. But what happened was I was so anomalous. Like, I'm a white guy. I'm in my mid-50s. I got gray hair. I'm driving this cab around. People would get in, and they would start interviewing me. And so instead of being a foreign correspondent trying to extract information from people in an authoritarian country, they felt like, hey, I'm in charge. I'm asking these questions. They were terribly, terribly curious. And then I would explain, I'm a reporter. Here's why I'm doing it. And most times they would say, that sounds like a great idea. What kind of stories are you hearing? Because, you know, in China, everybody's interested in learning about what's going on in China, even the Chinese people, of course. And it's not as easy as it would be in, say, Auckland or other cities where you can just go out and chat with people on a street corner. You can't talk about sensitive subjects publicly. You can chat about most things, but not that. And so this was an opportunity to begin to talk about things that were sensitive to people. And since I was getting to know them over a period of years, I basically just was patient and waited for them to bring up topics.
And the first passenger we meet is Chen, a pajama salesman who sent his family to the United States. Why did he do that?
He was a really fascinating person. At this time, this was about 2014 when I met him. In Shanghai, you know, I'm sure people there in New Zealand know exactly what it looks like. It's like the Emerald City from The Wizard of Oz. I mean, it's huge towers. It's very, very wealthy. And when I met Chen, what was so interesting is here was a guy when China had never been wealthier and he wanted to leave the country. He wanted to get his elder daughter out of the country because she was suffering under the education system. It was a terrible amount of homework. Her teachers hit her. Her eyesight was beginning to fail, and he just felt he needed to get her somewhere else, and he chose the United States. He also wanted to have a second child, and he was banned from doing that because of the one-child policy, which was the rule at the time but has since changed. And so he basically, you know, he had an exit strategy, and I found that really interesting at a time when China was so prosperous that there were people who did very much want to get out.
Yeah, you write that he wanted something more civilized, more sustainable. And we see thousands of Chinese migrating here in New Zealand and sending their children here to be educated. I guess Chen's story illuminates this maybe wider dissatisfaction and the desire to have some sort of, as you call it, an exit strategy.
I think what it is that money is not enough anymore. You know, I think in the old days for a lot of people, because China was relatively poor, just doing better financially was enough. But people are looking for meaning in their lives. China is an exhausting place to live. It's incredibly competitive. It's hard to get into the best schools. Healthcare is difficult and expensive. Getting on the property ladder in major cities is very difficult. And so I think people are tired. And I also think that they're not very happy with the government. Chen actually ran an underground Christian house church. It was illegal. He didn't want to be a part of the state church. So he had different values. And no matter how much the GDP was growing in China, he wanted more out of life. And what was most important is he wanted a different life for his kids. We certainly see in the United States, you know, we have over 300,000 Chinese students in the United States. And a lot of that is Chinese parents would like their kids to have a little more creative and a little more open kind of educational system, less of the rote learning that still exists very much in the Chinese system.
And Chen was eventually able to join his family in Los Angeles, and he told you another reason he wanted to get out of China, something he never mentioned it when he lived in Shanghai.
No, and I don't think many of his family or friends really know the story. This took a few years for him to tell me what had really happened, and that's why I also think that this was a good method of getting to know people over a period of time. They would eventually feel comfortable telling you. His wife back in the early 2000s had been forced to have an abortion in Shanghai. She was basically hauled out of her apartment one night, taken to a hospital and strapped down, and they forced an abortion on her. There was nothing she could do about it. She described it to me when I was sitting in their kitchen in Los Angeles, and it was a very painful conversation. And it helped explain why they didn't want to have anything to do with the government anymore and to live under that system. What's amazing, though, I would say, is how tough they were. I mean, she was physically affected by this. Her organs were damaged.
So she was physically tough.
She was very tough. And the thing is that she went to the United States And she made a life for herself. And sometimes that meant sleeping in their car and her daughter going to McDonald's and washing up every morning for school. But there is a real resilience among a lot of Chinese and certainly a lot of the people that I got to meet.
You mentioned Max, the barber.
Yeah.
Another one who yearns for a kinder, gentler China.
Yeah, I really liked Max so much. I mean, Max's story was so interesting because he actually was forced to leave his village because a lot of his friends were junkies. He lived in the edge of the Golden Triangle, which is a heavy opium growing area. And so his brother made him leave. And then he went on this kind of walkabout of sorts, and he got job after job. And eventually he was able to become successful in Shanghai. But he felt he really owed a debt to his parents because he had left them behind. And so he ended up cutting the hair of these shut-ins. And I went and traveled with him. And I think that this shows something that's also very important about China. We talk about how dystopian it can be, how competitive it can be. But now that people have more money, they also are doing more charity work. They are kinder to each other because they're less worried about making ends meet every day. And so I would say, actually, in a lot of ways, I saw a lot more altruism in China in 2016 than I would have seen it in China of 1997.
Actually, one of the more disturbing scenes in the book is something you witnessed involving some Buddhists trying to save fish.
Yeah, that was kind of a metaphor for some of the worst aspects of society there. This was just near my apartment, and this was, I think, a great metaphor for sort of the light and dark of Chinese society at times. You had these Buddhists, and they would come to the riverbanks right in the financial district. So here you have these huge towers, three of them taller than the Empire State Building, and they would pour fish into the river, and they were trying to release life and save the fish from being eaten. And then just downstream, there would be these men with these really long poles with nets on the end, and they would scoop the fish right out of the river, and sometimes two and three at a time, and then take them and sell them. They told me they ate them themselves, but I didn't believe them. And one night, sort of the most indelible image for me was one night I went out to watch them do this, and it was low tide in the river, and there was a man in waders standing in the river intercepting the fish as they floated downstream.
I'm speaking with Frank Langford, a former Shanghai-based national public radio correspondent, now based in London, and his book is called The Shanghai Free Taxi: Journeys with the Hustlers and Rebels of the New China. Tradition remains important to Chinese despite the change. Frank, there's still a pull to go home. How eye-opening was it to drive Rocky and Charles to their rural villages for a wedding in Chinese New Year?
Yeah, it was a wonderful trip. And I had done it many, many years earlier, but that had been by train. This time we drove back. And I think it was very interesting because in the case of Rocky, he went back home, and this was the village where he grew up. And he missed the rural life. He missed the quiet. He missed the relationships. At the same time, he was now a city boy. He was now a lawyer. And he told me at one moment, he said, it's wonderful to be back, but if I stay here for two or three more, if I stay here for more than a few days, I begin to feel uncomfortable because he no longer fits in. And what we've seen, particularly in the last 20 years in China, it has gone from an agricultural country, a rural country, to a very much an urban and fast-paced, in some ways now post-industrial country. It comes back to what you were talking about earlier, the rapid, rapid pace of change, and how difficult that is for people to grapple with, and also how it affects their identity. You start off as a kid and you're a farm boy, and then, by the time you're in your 30s, you're living in a city of 26 million.
Driving the highways in China is not quite like the motorways in the West, Frank.
No, it's not. In Shanghai, it was a game of inches. I mean, there's so many cars on the street. And I always was very careful to try to edge my way around and just make sure I never hit anybody, because the last thing you want is conflict. But also, as you get out into the rural areas, there really are no rules at all, in my experience. And I remember once when I was in central China on a superhighway, I was heading down the road, and a man in front of me, a driver in front of me, had missed his exit. And instead of just continuing on and finding the next exit, he did a U-turn and began driving back into the oncoming traffic. And it was like, it was like watching a Die Hard movie where the hero turns around and drives down the expressway in the wrong direction. But that sort of thing is not completely out of the ordinary. And all I did is I just pulled over to the shoulder, let him go past. But it's very the rules of the road, particularly outside of the big cities, are quite loose, and it's not for the faint of heart.
That wedding ceremony we mentioned included a tribute to Xi Jinping. Is that heartfelt or is that just good politics?
It's interesting. They played that music. It is heartfelt. I think this is very important for people in the United States, but also in New Zealand and Australia to understand. Xi Jinping remains very popular in a lot of ways. So the crackdown on corruption, which began, I want to say, 2012, corruption in the country when I got back there in 2011 was out of control. It was like metastasized cancer, and it was threatening. It was threatening the future of the Communist Party. President Xi basically launched the toughest anti-corruption campaign in the history of the Communist Party, put more than a million people in jail. And even liberals who didn't like his politics would say to me, I really appreciate him doing this because it was driving people crazy. So in a sense, Xi is a classic populist politician. He knew what people were concerned about. He knew it was undermining his rule, and he addressed it in a very effective and ruthless way. Now, more recently, because it has gotten much more repressive in China, and certainly we've seen what's happened with the camps in Xinjiang and things along those lines, there are more people, at least those who are aware of these things, that have much bigger questions about him, and they are more uneasy. And the turning point clearly was when they got rid of term limits for the president. The Communist Party removed term limits so that President Xi could, in theory, rule until he died. Mm. And that scares a lot of people because of what happened with Mao. Mao was able to rule forever. He nearly destroyed the country twice with the Cultural Revolution and then the Great Leap Forward at great cost to the country. People don't want to see that happen again. So I think people in the last 2 years are more ambivalent about President Xi and, frankly, a bit more afraid of him.
You met a used car salesman named Beer while shopping for
your
car.
Yes, I did.
How is his Chinese brand of hustler different from the sort of used car salesman you might find in the West?
Well, I think that I felt that Beer, he was one of a kind. I've never met a used car salesman or any car salesman or salesman at all quite like Beer. When I first met him, he introduced himself and he said he had taken the English name Beer because he liked to drink a lot of beer. And he invited me to go drinking with him. And then as I tried to find a car, I would ask him, I would say, I'd like to look at a Toyota. He would take me to a Honda. He was always trying to lead me in a different direction from what I wanted to do. And he was also very touchy, which is not normally what Chinese folks are like. So he was quite a character. And in the end, I just couldn't buy a car from him because I felt like I was going to get conned. But it was a very, very interesting experience. And I think, you know, Chinese people, young Chinese people are much more individualistic. He said that he was particularly touchy because it's kind of his way. And also he thought it was a way to kind of establish trust and a rapport with a Western person.
You talk about the dark side of the Chinese dream in the book, and you met the sister of a woman who disappeared in 2013. What does her story tell us about the flip side of the sort of the bright economic success of China?
Yeah, I thought that this was very interesting. A lot of people work very hard. A lot of Chinese are very capable, and they're able to, certainly almost everybody in the book has a considerably better life materially than their parents. But, you know, if you don't have the connections, if you also don't have necessarily the aptitude, what we've seen in the last 20, 25 years is many women coming out of the provinces going to work, becoming sex workers. And this is, prostitution is rampant throughout China. And this was a woman who, her sister had been quite successful, had become a nurse, eventually had gone and worked in Michigan, was an IT, worked in the IT industry. The younger sister, her name is Winnie, didn't have the same aptitude. She got involved in sex work, became a mistress, and then tried to turn her life around, went down to southern China, and then really struggled, got involved with a married man. And so it was a very interesting tale of two sisters where in this sort of market economy of China, you could do well, but you also, if you didn't have the right abilities and if you made bad decisions, you could do very poorly. She disappeared. We never ultimately were able to find out what happened to her because our search became quite dangerous. It was very clear we were getting into very deep and dark waters in doing this. And it's interesting because if you would go back 40 years ago under communism, their lives would have been quite circumscribed. They would have probably lived a similar life wouldn't have traveled very far from home. But in China, there's the opportunity now to do very well, to travel overseas, but there's also the chance that things could go very badly for you. And she wasn't the only character in the book, only person in the book, who did find, you know, a big reversal in their fortunes.
We are just about out of time. I just want to quickly ask you about Hong Kong, because Ashley is the daughter of Communist Party officials and does business in Hong Kong. Do you know what she thinks about the protests?
She told me, we talked last week about this, she said if she'd been raised in Hong Kong, she would be out there on the streets all the time as well. She understands very much why people in Hong Kong feel so strong about this. But she also works, she's a mainlander, and she works with a lot of mainlanders, and she said there's very little sympathy among mainlanders for these protesters in Hong Kong, as I'm sure a lot of your listeners, they probably know. Mainlanders have been coming to Hong Kong for a long time, buying up baby formula, lots of products, as well as housing. Baby formula because there's a food is not safe in China, so they're always looking for something safe, and they go to Hong Kong. They buy this all out. They drive up the prices of real estate. There's a lot of resentment of Hong Kong people towards mainlanders, and they treat mainlanders quite badly. Mainlanders now harbor that. They're pretty bitter about that, including some friends of mine who are mainlanders who are very sophisticated. They go to Hong Kong. They're not treated well. The other thing is that there is an independence streak in Hong Kong. There is some talk a little bit, I don't think it'll ever go anywhere, of Hong Kong becoming independent of the mainland. That angers many mainlanders. They feel that that's treason. So it's interesting. You have this push for democracy in Hong Kong, for the continue the rule of law. You would think that people living under an authoritarian system just across the border, who are also Chinese, would be more supportive. In fact, they aren't. And that's it really speaks to the great division between young people in Hong Kong and young people right across the border in the mainland.
The book is called The Shanghai Free Taxi: Journeys with the Hustlers and Rebels of the New China. Frank Langfitt, thank you very much for your time today. Great idea, great execution.
Thank you.
And all the best.
Well, I appreciate your interest. This was great fun. Thanks.